I received an invitation the other day to speak on the theme, the alienated Jewish youth. Now, as I read the invitation, where and the when, I bethought myself that this was such a typically Jewish invitation. It assumed the worst, and it invited the speaker to give the audience the pleasure of a half hour of happy suffering. It's cut of the same cloth as that apocryphal dialogue, the two men who pass. The one pays very little attention to the amenities. His friend turns to him and says, "What's the matter? Are you high-hatting me? Can't you ask me how I am?" And the other one says to him, "Well, Nu, how are you?" And he says, "You shouldn't ask." This topic, which I had been invited to lecture on, the alienated Jewish youth, disturbed me on other counts. It assumed the line of thought which a man should take. Alienation means to be put off by. The topic assumes that if there is a separation, a gap, between our young people and our own faith, the nature of that gap lies in the inability of our institutions, their archaic condition, their irrelevance, whatever the word may be, their inability to meet the needs of the young. With such a topic, the fault inevitably lies with the institution, the synagogue, the school, the Jewish community. And inevitably, you are led to analyze these deficiencies, and obviously they exist. Every institution is by nature inadequate to its full range of needs. And then to suggest the strategies by which the institutions can be made over so that they reflect the thoughts of the young and are apposite to their requirements. It doesn't permit the other possibility that the young have no use for these institutions because the old faith teaches a series of values which the pop culture does not affirm. Values having to do with modesty, decency, and patient reason, and humility, none of which I find in great verbal affirmation and commitment among our young people. And so I chose the topic fathers and sons, Judaism as it looks across the generation gap, in order to free myself from the bind of assuming that we, the elderly, are always at fault. We and our institutions are inevitably wrong, and that we must listen to whatever the young people say, however misinformed or misguided or impromptu or irrelevant, and restructure 4,000-year-old institutions, remake the oldest history, the oldest religion in the history of men to meet the needs of the moment. Now, all this is not to say that the synagogue, the school, and the Jewish community do not need reformation. They do. It is to suggest that whatever reformulation is required must be in context with the entire thrust of our religious tradition. That if we simply make ourselves over into an echo chamber, which refracts to the young what the young are already thinking, which accepts the values of the society simply because the society affirms them, we are not only untrue to our heritage, but ultimately classically irrelevant, because we have nothing to say and no purpose for being. We make no contributions to the growth, the maturation, the insight, or the understanding of the generations. 2 weeks ago, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the overall body of all the Reformed congregations, met in Miami. And a great deal of the mood which had impelled the letter writer to write me asking me if I would speak on the alienated Jewish youth infected this convention. The whole mood was one, let's listen to what the young people are saying and do it. Let's do their thing. Every congregation had been asked to send down young people. And after every discussion, whoever was in charge of the panel would say, let's give the young people a chance. And they would come to the microphone and make great impromptu pronouncements, damning this and condemning that. And I found myself quite put off. Here we have 4,000 years of insight and understanding, and suddenly we must bow and kowtow to whatever a 16-year-old is saying off the top of his head. And the very strategy which comes out of this approach disturbs me. Not because, as you know, I'm unwilling to see the synagogue turn itself inside out, if that's what's required, in order to do our thing. But because the strategy which seemed to be developing was this. Let's turn the synagogue into four walls in which what takes place everywhere else in our society is to take place. If there are coffee houses, let the synagogue be a coffee house. If there are jam sessions, that's what a service should be. The main evening of this convention was devoted to an evening of music for the Jewish community in the synagogue of the future. Whoever had put the convention together had asked Dave Brubeck to compose the music for the synagogue of the future, and he composed music. And my music critic friend said it was good music. And I don't doubt it. But it had nothing to do with Jerusalem or Matsada, with Hillel or Maimonides, with 1948 or 1967. It had nothing to do with God or Torah or Israel. And that's the problem. And as the people walked around that night after this concert, one of my friends came up to me and told me of an experience he'd had. He'd been invited to a synagogue on Shabbat morning. And this was to be their service for youth. And they had on the pulpit a trio with electronic guitars called, of all things, the Gefilte Fish. And they had a folk rock service. And he said it wasn't bad. And there had been, in some parts, an attempt to express familiar values in a contemporary idiom. But what intrigued him was the fact that as he looked around the congregation, 9 out of 10 heads of hair were gray and white. The attempt to attract the young by becoming young-like failed. Because the synagogue isn't young, and it isn't on the other side, or the right side, of perhaps, of the generation gap. And the young people, if they come to the synagogue, will not come because we're saying what they're already saying. They can find the social action of the movement in the movement. They can find better folk rock music than we can produce in their bistros and coffee houses. The only way that we will be able to appeal to young or old, to anyone, is if we have something to say. And that's the real test which faces Judaism, in my estimation, at this stage in our history. I think we're surprised, and this is the whole point of this lecture this morning, I'm constantly surprised, I hope you will be surprised, at what young people are saying, how they're reacting to us. I want to try this morning to sweep away some of the preconceptions and assumptions which I think many of us have. Because what we do is this. We project ourselves into them. And we say, what would I have been like if I had their opportunity, if I was living today? And the answer is, I would be an alienated Jewish youth. What I'd like to suggest to you is, their experiences are not ours, their needs are not ours, and they are not the alienated Jewish youth of something other. I'd like to describe them for you. Perhaps the best way to begin is to read you a letter I received just this last week. You'll recall I wrote in the bulletin, two, 3 weeks ago, a challenge. I hope that there were those in the congregation would like to develop a meaningful and vital service, one which was truly valid to our tradition, yet would speak to them and of them and for them. Now this young man, who's at one of our Big Ten universities, wrote a letter to me. I don't know how he got a hold of the bulletin. I guess his mother had decided he'd been complaining about the service often enough, and he ought to sit down and do it, so she sent him the column. It begins this way. Dear Rabbi Silver, I'm writing to you out of a very large concern, which I must admit surprises me greatly. Now, he said, what I'm concerned with, however, is your announcement of a contest to write a contemporary service. He forgot I added the words valid and meaningful, but that's all right. I wouldn't have had the illustration this morning. He said, I find the effort misdirected at best. Religion can be said to be the search for control by giving meaning to the present. The present, after all, doesn't explain itself very well. It seems more often than not chaotic, random, purposeless, and destructive. Order, however, can be imposed. The past is one source for this order. Consequently, the past becomes inseparable from the present. The past is always relevant. The sermon, the service, assuming it's the one you used 5 years ago, is a meaningful one. Probably more so than any one which would be chock full of relevance, with a capital R. Another source of meaning, perhaps the richest, is ritual, which invests the present profane with a sense of sacred, mythological, no time, all time. What seems to me inevitable is that in a chromium service with its exclusion of ritual from worship will be no service at all. Ritual is, after all, what we've been doing all along. What we've been doing all along, therefore we will argue to write a chromium service, is what we want to get away from. We will argue that ritual is superstition in an age of science, and we will ruthlessly want to exorcise it like an unwanted ghost. But I can't but feel that in doing so, we sacrifice something extraordinarily valuable to a false god, the modern idolatry of relevance, which is, after all, only the chaotic present confusedly contemplating itself. Now, this is the voice of youth, but it's not the voice that we expect. The voice of youth has many forms. It doesn't fall neatly into any one label. Yes, there are the butterfly young who couldn't care less, whose entire relationship to Judaism is the fact that if they happen to be home from college around the high holidays, if the high holidays happen to come early enough, they'll condescend to come to worship with you. And there are some very angry young Jews today, particularly angry because Judaism won't put the Hechsher, won't say, yes, your particular economic philosophy, your particular radicalism is Judaism. We won't affirm and consecrate their peculiar ideology. And there are some who have gone completely from our ranks for reasons of love or pressures of the family into which they're marrying into, or because they have found a more meaningful, soul-satisfying spiritual discipline someplace else. Yes, it can happen. And does happen. But there are also young people, many of them going to Israel to spend every summer working there, spending their junior year at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Yes, our Hillels are busy, adequate places for many. Yes, 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, depending on the year, of your youngsters are enrolled in our high school. And compare that with 2 out of 10 who were enrolled 15 years ago. And yes, 1 in every 3 students who is Jewish as an undergraduate Case Western Reserve University will be enrolled in a course in Jewish studies before he is graduated. We have many, many different patterns of relationship. I asked the class that I teach in Judaism at Case Reserve last year, after the term was over and the exams and the papers were in, I asked the Jewish youngsters in the class to write me a paper on what Judaism meant to them. One youngster answered simply, no comment. Another said to me, Judaism is the religion to which I have finally relented. And a third said to me, I am currently involved, heart and soul, in trying to create a meaningful Jewish lifestyle. Many patterns of relationship, many different kinds of identification. Let me draw for you 4 or 5 of these portraits, because they escape the labels. There have been too many labels and too little looking at the phenomenon, at the individual themselves. There's one youngster. He's a senior now. In 1967, he Without asking his parents, he got himself aboard a plane to Jerusalem, and he worked during the summer to help out in one of the kibbutzim while the young men were fighting in the service. In 1968, he was a member of the New Democratic Coalition, the New Politics Conference, which met in Chicago, and he was one who voted to accept sight unseen the caucus of the platform of the Black Caucus, and knowing full well that it included a number of anti-Israel pronouncements. Another youngster has been very active as a leader of the more radical groups on the campus. He's a confirmed socialist, and as a socialist, he has nothing but contempt for the institutions of an organized religion. And for the last 3 years, he's been one of the co-chairmen of the United Jewish Appeal Campaign at Case Western Reserve University. A third youngster goes about the campus wearing a yarmulke and a beard. He's very visible and very active in Hillel. He's a graduate of an all-day school, and he has yet to tell his parents that he's married secretly to a Roman Catholic girl and that he has agreed to raise his children as Catholic. A fourth youngster was born a Catholic, was converted to Judaism two and a half years ago, has become fluent in Hebrew, has taken all the religion courses one can take at Case Western Reserve University. He's one of the brightest students I've ever had, and has applied for admission to the Hebrew Union College. I said it wrong, and she has applied for admission at the Hebrew Union College. Another youngster is a liberated son of a liberated family. He's a pre-law student in his last year. His family never belonged to anything in Jewish life. They lived in a small Massachusetts town. He was very much put off by the fact that we brought a girl home who was not Jewish. His parents treated her very coldly. He couldn't understand this. He says that there's no question in his mind that in his home the child will be raised to make up its mind whatever religion it wants to follow. There's going to be no question of any problem as far as religion is concerned. By and by, it probably would be best for the child to accept the majority faith. Why did he take the course? Well, he felt he owed Judaism something before he completely left it. He wrote me a paper as his final term paper on black Jewish relationships, in which he developed the thesis that anti-Semitism exists because there are Jews. It's all our fault. And when I refused to accept the paper, he turned to me in absolute startled amazement. He said, but why aren't you accepting it? I said, because it's factually untrue. And he said, but that's the way it has to be said. That's the liberated way. And when we got all through a two-hour debate, which I won, he had to redo the paper. He said to me, by the way, how do I go about planning to spend next summer in Israel? And he went. The varieties of identification, of relationship, there are many. Now, are there any kinds of, any trends that one can see in these, among the young? There are three that I'd like to suggest. They're not, they don't explain everything and perhaps even the ways of the majority, but they're very visible, and I think they may be surprising to you. The first is that there is a definite renaissance of interest in orthodoxy, in the more colorful, the more demanding, the more rigorous elements in Jewish life. There are 12,000 Jewish undergraduates at UCLA. There is a Hillel, a very liberal Hillel director. The community of Los Angeles sent onto the campus a year ago a very bright young man who's a Reform rabbi, a graduate of Cincinnati, who speaks the language of the young, who echoes most of their values. They thought that he could relate with him. And you know the only place where Jewish action is? It's a little house just off the UCLA campus, which was bought 3 years ago by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Hasidic rabbinic leader from Brooklyn, with his long coat, and his fur hat, and it's there that every Shabbos afternoon 300 or 400 young Jews come to sing and to dance. That's the only place where the action is. I had a youngster last year write me this on the paper I told you about and what Judaism means to me. I am a Jew. I am a Jew by education. I attended a Reform religious school for 12 years. I was bar mitzvah and conformed in the tradition and confirmed in the tradition of Reform Judaism. I am a Jew by conversion. I was converted to Judaism in the sight of 3 Orthodox rabbis in Cleveland on March 30th, 1969. Now that's a physical impossibility. You're born a Jew, you are a Jew, and as a born Jew, you can't be converted to Judaism. But her very need for this bespeaks a need which I've seen in many young people. We think that because we brought Judaism up to date, because we did away with many of the medievalisms of the past and we made it appealing, we made it simple, we made it relatively inchoate, unformed, but the young today want something which has structure and form and color and life to it, not something which simply tends to echo the prevailing reforming or liberal tendencies in the society. And so there's a sizable minority, 7%, 10%, who are making the long way back from unaffiliated homes, from reform homes, from conservative homes, to traditional Judaism, particularly to Hasidic Judaism, with the dance and the color and the meaning. And there's a search among many others for a complete Jewish lifestyle. In Boston and in New York, and in Philadelphia, there are now groups called Chavurot. They're small, 50, 75 people, young people, who have come together to live together in apartment communes where they can create a relevant form of Jewish life, that's their term, where they can throw themselves into traditions but recast traditions to meet their needs, where they can be radical or liberal or reforming in their daily work, but totally Jewish in this, their new home. They're creating a counter home because the homes that they come from are for them too bland, too relatively indifferent to what it means towards being a Jew. The second pattern, which I'd like to suggest to you, flows really from the first, and that is that even among those who are not making the trip back towards Hasidism and towards Orthodoxy, there's a sizable minority who want a form of worship far richer, far more moving, far more demanding of one's whole, of a response of one's whole body and form than anything that a reform or conservative congregation produces. They want to dance their Judaism. They want to sing their Judaism. They want to do it in the synagogue and out. In several colleges this year, at Rosh Hashanah time, they held their services dancing in the fields. In several places, at Pesach, they've held the Seder, the Feast of Deliverance, down in the ghetto. Something in going there was existential, gave it existential meaning, spoke to them of the needs of freedom in our society. All across the campus today, you find a need to express one's soul, to participate in the movement, in the drama of a cathartic experience. That's what the drug scene is. The desire to look within and to find a deeply moving, quotation mark, spiritual experience. And if our young Jews are not running off to some guru, or if they're not contemplating the ineffable in some neo-Buddhist monastery in California, they are reflecting the same kinds of pressures which bring other youngsters to the guru. A desire to do something more than to sit and to read from a book. A desire to worship their God, body and soul, totally. And the third element, which may surprise you, is the growing interest in Judaism as an intellectual discipline. What they get from their Sunday schools is not enough from them. What they get from their homes is often a cold shoulder. They come home with questions about God or the meaning of Jewish history, and mother and father want to question them about their dates and whom they're going out with, and there are ships that pass in the night. There's no communication. They're vitally interested, many of them, in knowing what this Judaism is all about on an adult, intellectual, a conceptual level. We have 225 youngsters from Case Reserve in classes in Judaism right now. There are 90 chairs in Jewish study across the country and many other courses offered one at a time on various campuses, and they're drawing young people. They're the fastest growing courses in terms of attendance on the campus. There's a tremendous need to know something more than one's bar mitzvah portion, to be able to judge Judaism in its own terms as a mature faith, as a mature person. Now, none of this we really expect. We think of the alienated Jewish youth. We assume his disinterest. And I ask myself, why? What leads us to these assumptions? And what I'd like to suggest now is really what I suggested earlier, that we come to them because this is how we think we would be reacting if we were young today. Most of us are the children of a different age. We were born under a different ideological star in a different climate. We were born into a world which really was discovering Darwin, though he'd written for 100 years before, which thought inevitably in terms of evolution. Things which were old were necessarily discarded, and the new was necessarily bright and good. Religion was old. Religion was therefore medieval, not modern. And this conformed well with our need to escape from the ethnicism of our homes, from the accent, from the foreignness, from the immigrant quality which was there. We wanted to be 100% American, whatever that meant. If you look back on your college careers, can you imagine half of the young Jews on the campus walking about with yarmulkes on their head? Jews were changing their noses so they would look less Jewish. Today, they wear the symbol of their Judaism around their neck, a mezuzah, the girls, the yarmulke on their head. One of the most arresting sights of any is that when you see the protest, the racial protest, the peace protest, the Jews identify themselves by wearing the yarmulke as their protest symbol. That didn't happen a generation ago. It's a totally new kind of world. And whether we agreed with Marx or not, and most of us did not, there was something in our world which said that human problems would be solved by social engineering. That human problems would be solved by reforming the economy or reforming the social structure. And we always looked without. We were outward directed towards citizenship, towards doing. Now, these young people are also outward directed, perhaps more than some of us would like. But they no longer look as we look to confirmation of their social crusades in the religion. They're not very much impressed when the pulpit pounds itself about, you know, the moratorium next week or the civil rights crusade. That's old hat to them. They have it every day. We looked for confirmation of what we were doing to the synagogue. And we're a little bit disappointed if it didn't give us direction. They don't look for that kind of confirmation here. They look for us to be religious. They look for the authenticity of the spiritual moment. They look for the meaningfulness of the worship. They look for the quality of the debate, of the discussion, of the dialogue, of the educational system. That's what they expect from the synagogue. And if they find only a pale refraction of the kind of discussion of social issues which they had 3 years ago, then we're turned off. And if we justify ourselves purely on Isaiah and Jeremiah, on, you know, justice, justice shall thou pursue, they say, so what? What's new? What else have you got to say? Now, their world is inner directed. as well as out of directing. They're not afraid of feeling. That's the great generational difference. They start where they are. They want to know who they are, what they feel and why. What is it like inside? What am I really after? And if we don't provide the quiet, the spiritual moment, the encouragement, the listening ear, we have nothing to offer them. And if we don't dredge out of our tradition those great trends in Jewish life, which are mystical, which are quietistic and pietistic, we will be making a great mistake. Because these are the elements to which, in large measure, they respond. And then we came to, in our own development, to Mr. Freud, and we began to develop a lot of very loose talk that religion was nothing more than a projection of men's needs, that God was nothing more than a divine reflection of a father image. And we became very glib about it all, and we really didn't need God very much because we were God. We were confident that we could create with our own hands the good society, that we would, with one war, end all wars, create peace, that we would, with our medicine, create healing, that we would, with our technology, create a city in which men could live with some decency and some amenity. That was our great hope. And we couldn't see God because we had a mirror in front of our eyes. Our hopes have been shattered. But they were shattered for us in adult life by Auschwitz, by Hiroshima, by the chaos which constantly surrounds us. These young people were raised in a world which, for all of its abundance, had very little hope to it. We were cocksure. They're not sure at all. They were raised on Failsafe, The Lord of the Flies, 1984, the hydrogen bomb, the population bomb. These are their realities. Yes, they'll fight the fights for a reformation of our society. What else can one do? But they fight it without the conviction that they're going to win. It's one of the reasons they fight it with such desperation. And with it all, with this sense that we can die young. We may not live out our destiny. We may not be able to solve human problems, because really human problems are insoluble. Comes a desperate need to touch bedrock, to find again a God who has given and implanted an embedded purpose into the universe. And to a theologian who talks vaguely about a God idea, these youngsters respond, "Talk to me about God, or don't talk to me about at all." And if you equivocate, they want certainty. They'll go in the search. If you're serious in what you're doing religiously, if you're searching for God and for meaning, they'll walk along with you. But if you've created what has often been created in the modern synagogue and in the modern church, a godless ecclesiastical institution, they don't need it. They want no part of it. One of them said to me the other day, "You know, I'm sick and tired of hearing these words alienated, uncommitted, applied to my generation. If anything, it applies to yours." He said, "What's a high holiday Jew in on Rosh Hashanah, out on Yom Kippur, if not an uncommitted Jew?" He said to me, "Most of my father's friends say, I obey the Ten Commandments. Of course, I don't go to shul. But I obey the Ten Commandments." He said, "That means that they pay their taxes. They don't beat their wives." He said, "Is that being a committed Jew? Stop talking about us as the uncommitted generation. Look at yourselves." And there's much to it. Because what I've been trying to say is what I have found with the young. A desire to relate. A thrust, a need. And it's to this that we must respond. They want the synagogue, the community, to respect the values it mouths. If we are condemned in their eyes of any sin, it would be the sin of hypocrisy. The institution, the rabbi, the federation, the community, which does not live up to its profession, is convicted. The synagogue, which does not seriously try to come to grips with the commandments, the mitzvot, there's no synagogue in their eyes, and they won't relate to it. They'll create their own, an anti-synagogue, an underground synagogue, a place where they can find integrity as they understand it. That's the challenge that they throw out to us. Not to create folk rock services or electronic music, that's tinsel. Not to translate our prayers into their idiom, you know, transforming, as I saw once, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might, and to love baby, love the big boy. That doesn't mean anything to them. Doing our thing does. And our thing is a very, very old thing. It has to do with discipline and respect for others as well as for ourselves. It has to do with righteousness and feeling, respect for another's feeling. It has to do with an affirmation of the usefulness of life and the purposefulness of life. And beyond life and in life and throughout life, it affirms God. None of these disciplines, personal or theological, come easily to the middle-aged and the mildly involved, to us. None of these disciplines, personal or otherwise, come easily to the young. But by God, they're going to try. Many of them. And I hope to God that we, as far as we are involved in our religious institutions and the institutions, are capable of meeting this challenge. Because it's certainly a worthy one, worthy of them, worthy of us.